From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 396 for this May the 6th, 2012. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin and we're broadcasting live from News Talk Radio 580 CFRA and taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255. Star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And in the news today, before we get to our calls, and I encourage you to call in early, we have a couple of people, Rick in Hintonburg and John in Ottawa, are already on the online waiting to ask their questions, and encourage you to call in early as well and get you on the line and deal with some of the issues that are of concern to you. From BBC News today, I thought this was very interesting. This is very early research, but what I found encouraging about this is the direction that it is going and the possibilities that are open with regards to treating a lot of what are called neurodegenerative diseases. These are diseases such as Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, even things such as mad cow disease, or what they're called prion diseases, Huntington's chorea, things that cause damage to the brain that result in tremendous suffering for people. In this case, this was a study that was published in Nature, carried out by researchers at the University of Leicester, the Medical Research Council Laboratory in Leicester. And what they did is that they tried to understand what the mechanisms were that led to the death of brain cells. In this case, it was a mouse study with what's called a prion disease. And as I mentioned, prion diseases are things such as mad cow disease, which literally poke holes in brain tissue and also cause abnormal proteins to deposit in the brain tissue. Now, these abnormal proteins, you can think of them as literally pieces of chewing gum or a sticky mass of things that bind up and literally form a spider web around normal cells. And what they found is that the way normal brain cells try to protect themselves against these abnormal proteins from this disease is that they shut down the production of the regular proteins that they make. And proteins are chemical compounds that the body uses for enzymes, for building blocks for tissue, for repairing tissue, for sending chemical messages. I mean, proteins abound in our bodies. And so they found, again, that when, for example, a brain cell is infected with a virus or cells are infected with a virus, it shuts down protein production to try and stop the virus from making copies of itself. Well, the same mechanism is used with, in this case, prion diseases, and it just shuts down the protein production. The problem is that if you shut down the factory for too long, the brain cells eventually die and they can't function and you have further deterioration. So in this case, what they're saying is, you know, in Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease, we see abnormal proteins build up in the tissue and the brain cells tend to deteriorate over time. Could this be a similar mechanism? And so what they did is, as you're aware, that proteins are produced from a blueprint. The blueprint is found in our DNA, and essentially the DNA is the code from which you can create a recipe book to make all the things that your body needs to function properly. Well, there's a switch in this DNA, or in this case, it'll be RNA, which makes the protein, a switch that the researchers were able to turn off. And by turning the switch off, they prevented the brain from stopping the production of the normal proteins. So in other words, it allowed the brain cells to function normally. And what they found when they did this is that they allowed the mice to actually function better, and it prevented the brain cells from dying in these mice that had these prion diseases. It didn't necessarily get rid of the prion disease, and that wasn't the focus of this particular study. It was rather to show that, you know, we can get into the mechanism and structure of how the brain protects itself and improve its ability to protect itself and also to maintain these cells and keep them alive. So now that they've shown this, it's called a proof of concept. Now that they showed this proof of concept, it allows them now to apply this on the human level, conduct clinical trials, at least see if the same mechanism exists in human brain cells, and look at the ways of trying to treat Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. It's still very early. This by no means is something that's going to happen tomorrow or next year or in 2 years. It's likely many, many years down the road. But what this does illustrate is that people are trying to uncover the basic building blocks of how our bodies function and applying that in a way so that you can bolster that function and inhibit the damage that occurs from diseases for which now we really don't have the greatest treatments available. We can slow down progression of some of these diseases, compensate for some of the losses that the for compounds that the brain cells make by giving people them to take by mouth. But really, it's a delaying tactic that really, although helps people, it's not the definitive treatment. So I found this very encouraging. It was published in the journal Nature just this past week. And this was found on BBC News Health, and it was published today. And it's entitled Range of Brain Diseases Could Be Treated by Single Drug by James Gallagher, a health and science reporter for BBC News. So I thought that was very interesting. It's very encouraging. And it does give some hope in terms of how research is ongoing and trying to help people out. The other thing I wanted to bring up very quickly is the Centers for Disease Control has come up with their tally of the number of cancers that are hitting men and women from human papillomavirus. Human papillomavirus is a sexually transmitted virus. There is a vaccine for it that is given to girls only right now, although it is recommended for boys, and as a means of preventing cervical cancer, anal cancers, throat cancers, and such. And the HPV, or human papillomavirus, from the CDC causes 18,000 cancers in women each year. And for Canada, you can pretty much divide that by 10 and causes 8,000 cancers in men. And so the CDC collected data from 2004 to 2008 in two large cancer registries. They found that it causes, and we're seeing a dramatic increase in mouth and throat cancers. Especially in men. Men are four times more likely to get those type of cancers. And these are preventable. These illnesses, HPV, is found in over 20 million people in the United States. They carry the virus, which means about 2 million Canadians do. It is the most common sexually transmitted virus now. And it is also seen at least half of all people, sexually active people, get HPV at some time during their lives. Although HPV clears within a year or two for many people, there are those where the virus continues and causes damage and leads to the development of cancers. Hence, vaccinating young girls before they enter the age of sexual maturity to be able to prevent the diseases altogether, or at least mitigate that, for the same reason that we give hepatitis B vaccine, which is also a sexually transmitted disease, to be able to prevent hepatitis and liver cancers. The push is now on for vaccinating boys for exactly this reason. You reduce the risk of cancers in men, and also you reduce the risk of transmission of the virus between men and women and between same-sex couples as well. So we have evidence that there is a significant issue with regards to cancers. We have a vaccine that's available. The vaccine has been found to be safe and effective. And the issue is that there isn't as much uptake as we would like to see in people getting their children vaccinated. We're going to take a short break and come back to your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, *588 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is a long distance number. You're listening to Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
There's nothing to do here, some just whine and complain.
521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is a long distance number. And good afternoon to Rick in Hintonburg. How you doing?
Yeah, good afternoon, Dr. Dorkin. A long time no speak.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. I have my main question, as I told you, the screener.
Yes.
But I've got a very quick one I'll just throw in there.
Sure.
It's not serious at all. But during the winter time, the apartment that I live in is very dry.
Yes.
As most apartments are. And I've got a small humidifier, but it can never keep up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can never get to that level of maybe 50% humidity, or so it never gets there.
Right.
And as a result, particularly on the lower leg, like the calf area,
the skin gets very dry.
It's very dry.
Yes.
And this winter, for the first time, I noticed on both, say, I call them, say, a shin bone,
mm-hmm.
I had a spot about the size of a loony. That was red,
mm-hmm.
and very dry, and sort of the skin was just sort of flaked off.
Yep.
And but I started to, maybe 3 weeks or so ago, I started to just put hand cream on it, hand lotion,
mm-hmm.
and I've noticed that they're fading. It's fading.
Okay.
And I was just wondering, because the shape of it was, I found, very odd, you know. Both legs, both spots, and you have like the size of a loony, you know?
Right.
But they seem to be fading, so I'm not too worried about that.
Yeah, you can get, especially the wintertime, you can get what's called winter eczema. And sometimes if you see these round areas, you know, sort of like coin size, as you
mm-hmm.
mentioned, that's something that it can be one of a few things. But in terms of eczema, I usually call that nummular eczema. Or it can also be, you know, sometimes they can be fungal infections, but it would be rare to see that occurring on both legs at the same time. It just doesn't work like that.
Mm-hmm.
Putting the cream on is okay. There are specific lotions and topical agents that you can use that don't require a prescription to keep the skin moist. And
yeah.
So some of them, with no specific, you know, I can list them out, but there's no specific preference. I don't want people to assume that the first one I'm giving is the one that I'm recommending.
Right.
But there are ones such as things called Eucerin, or there's Uramol. There's also Spectro Eczema Care. There's a Vino lotion. There's a whole bunch of topical agents that can keep the skin moist and
mm-hmm.
prevent the water from being literally sucked out of the skin because the air is so dry.
Yeah.
And so go ahead.
Well, normally what happens as the spring comes in the summer, it goes away anyway. You know,
yes.
the dryness goes away by itself. So.
Exactly. But it's the wintertime where it gets really irritating.
Exactly.
And it's important, especially in the wintertime, when the skin gets like that, to keep it as supple as possible. Because when you have tissue that gets dried out, the normal oily surface that keeps the skin intact and prevents, literally acts as a barrier to infection and other, you know, foreign bodies and pathogens, it breaks down. And so the normal bacteria that we have on the surface of our skin that do us no harm, in fact, protect us because it's on the surface, when it gets underneath the skin, when the skin cracks and gets scaly, can cause secondary bacterial infections.
Mm-hmm.
So by preventing that, by keeping the skin in shape, as it were, you reduce the risk of causing damage or infections, local infections to the tissue.
Okay, that's good to know for next winter.
All right. Now, you had a question about Hyzar.
Well, you know, I've
yes.
I thought I had my problems with Hyzar.
Yeah.
But what is, since then, I bought a book. It's a Complete Guide to Prescriptions and Non-Prescription Drugs.
Okay.
2011 edition. And they list everything from A to Z in there. And going through it, I've looked up Hyzar. Now, when I had the Hyzar, it was Hyzar combined with a diuretic.
Right, which is the hydrochlorothiazide.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Now, but just looking up Hyzar by itself and at the side effects, you know, they are not the side effects that I had
mm-hmm.
at the time. Now, when I'm looking up just a couple of pages on there. Well, the Hyzar, I was told at one point, was an ACE inhibitor.
It's actually an angiotensin receptor blocker.
Exactly.
Yes.
And that's what I'm reading at the top of the page here.
Right.
So I didn't have those side effects. Now, when I'm looking at the couple of pages over, anti-angiotensin converting enzyme ACE inhibitors.
Right.
There's two pages of those, and this would be part of the diuretic. And these are these are the symptoms I had: was the swelling of the mouth, face, hands, mm-hmm. feet, difficulty breathing. You know, all of that.
Right.
That's what I had, and I'm just wondering if that was the diuretic part of the Hyzaar that I had taken.
Well, again, the diuretic is not an ACE inhibitor. So ACE inhibitor is a completely different class of medication from the diuretic. So the hydrochlorothiazide is not an ACE inhibitor. So that's the thing to keep in mind. So when you're looking at Hyzaar, for example, it's a combination of two medications. One, it's losartan, and the other is hydrochlorothiazide. So both of those together.
Okay.
So those in and of themselves are not related to ACE inhibitors at all.
Okay.
So the reaction that you had, the question becomes, now are you still taking the medication?
No.
Oh, okay.
The thing is, I don't know what to take now because, you know, they put me on Norvasc,
yeah.
Yeah, and I think I may have called you then. My feet swole
yes.
up like balloons.
Right.
And so I just don't know what to do. And, of course, I don't have a doctor.
Mm, that makes it even more difficult.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, again, you had a reaction to something. I remember we talked about this, and what you described certainly sounded like an allergy response. So you do want to try and avoid whatever the medication was at the time that you had that reaction.
Yeah.
That being said, there still are other medications that are available to treat blood pressure, and it's still very important to treat your blood pressure to reduce the risk of the various diseases that you already know about.
Yeah.
And so the issue becomes, okay, if you haven't had a reaction to the ARB itself, and that you had a reaction to potentially the diuretic, which is the assumption that's being made, you can certainly get antihypertensive medication that doesn't contain the diuretic and see if you have the same reaction. Ideally, you'd want to take the medication in the office and be observed for at least half an hour to an hour, because if you're going to have a reaction, it's going to happen within that time frame.
Okay, but when I was taking the Hyzaar,
mm-hmm.
it was on the eighth day. I'd taken it for 7 days
right,
without any problems. On the eighth day, that's when it hit me.
So then there must have been something else, because usually if there's going to be an allergic reaction in the manner that you had that reaction, that's a more, especially with the swelling and the you had the throat stuff as well, I think, right? You had
the
everything?
Throat, eyes, tongue, inside the mouth, chin, and the front of the throat.
And that usually implies a more immediate type of reaction. So there may have been something on and around that seventh or eighth day that either you had consumed or taken that gave you that reaction. So part of the issue becomes, is this from the medication? Is this from the medication in combination with something else that you took? Or is it something completely different altogether? And that's where we don't have a clear answer. So and it may be then hindering you from taking medications that would be beneficial for you, because we don't have that answer.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be a way to find out is to break that medication down into its two parts. So for example, starting off in the office, taking a diuretic, waiting 30 minutes, seeing what happens. If there's no reaction to that, it's very unlikely that you're allergic to that particular compound. Then come back in a few days, do the next test, take the ARB, in this case the losartan or that component of Hyzaar, and see what happens again. When you're in the office, it's easy enough to reverse an allergic reaction, right? There are medications that can be taken to reverse that relatively quickly.
Yeah.
But at least you will have an answer. And if you don't have those reactions in the office, it's unlikely that it was those medications. Then you would be saying, okay, I'd like to see an allergist to see if there's some food or some compound that I'm allergic to that may have caused this to happen.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the process I would take, Rick, in order to find out, because otherwise you're stuck, and I don't blame you for being worried about, you know, what kind of reaction you're going to have.
Yeah.
But we need to know. We need to know what you're reacting to, and that's one of the ways, one of the approaches that will at least give you a clear answer.
Yeah, but when you don't have a doctor, it makes it that much more difficult.
I know, we come back to that, and I wish I could help you with that, but that's... You have to call McGinty over that one, Rick.
Yeah, I know.
Right. Anyway, we have to break for the news, but thanks for
calling.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye now. And we're going to take a small break for the news and get to all your calls. You're listening to Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Back in just a few minutes after the news.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Don't you make me well.
CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
*5 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And over to line two, and John in Ottawa, good afternoon.
John, right?
Yes.
Hi, doctor, how are you?
I'm fine, how are you?
Not bad. I got a question to ask. I seem to be getting sick a lot. I'd just like to know, what is upper respiratory infection?
Well, upper respiratory infections usually comprise, for the most part, viral illnesses. Essentially, the common cold, cold viruses that usually affect the nose, the throat, the sinuses, sometimes the upper part of the chest where people cough a lot. There have been quite a few people that are coming in and saying, you know, I've had this condition for a month or 6 weeks or 2 months, and it doesn't seem to be going away. But when you ask through the history what's been happening, what you tend to find out is that over that time, they've started to get better, and then they got worse again. Then they started to get better, and then they got worse again. And that's very typical for viral infections. That is, the person is not experiencing just one infection. They're experiencing multiple ones, usually about 10 days apart, sometimes 2 weeks apart. You tend to see this more often, especially for people that are working indoors amongst a lot of other people. So there's a greater chance, especially in the wintertime, where you tend to see this.
I work with a lot of people in a building,
Yeah.
So I work with about 67 people in my building at my workplace every day.
Yeah, and so that's the most likely source for the infections. It's not dangerous. Viral upper respiratory tract infections are annoying. They can sometimes make you miss a day of work at times, cause a cough that doesn't want to seem to get better for several weeks. But all in all, in the end, your body will recover completely without really doing much of anything. There's no antibiotic to take. There's really nothing that's used for those type of infections.
My ahead. My doctor described two things, antibiotics and cough syrup.
Well, an antibiotic is not going to work very well for a viral infection.
And
the reason is if this is something you've had for a month, bacteria, because of the way bacteria grow, bacteria will double every 20 minutes. So if someone has a bacterial infection, what you tend to see is only one area of the respiratory tract that would become infected. So for example, someone that has a bacterial lung infection gets pneumonia, but they don't get a sore throat. They don't get a stuffed up nose. They don't get sinus pain. They have a cough that sometimes produces a lot of green sputum. They have a high fever, and they're generally feeling unwell, but it's just the lung that is affected. If they have, for example, a bacterial infection of the throat, that's usually what we call a tonsillitis or a strep throat, tend to have pain usually on one side of the throat. You look inside the throat, you see sometimes a tonsil that is quite large. It has pus on it. There are red dots on the surface, the top part of the mouth, the roof of the mouth. There can be fever, be very painful to swallow, but the nose is not congested and the lungs are fine. So that's the difference between viruses, which go everywhere. So it'll be throat, chest, nose, sinuses. Viruses will go along that whole upper respiratory tract. bacterial infections will infect only one part of that tract and only stay there. So okay. If you've had all these symptoms in all these different areas, an antibiotic is not going to do a thing for you.
No, I don't have all that. It was a really deep cough last week, and then I was sneezing a lot.
Right.
I went to my doctor a week ago, and she said, well, I didn't know what it was until 2 days later when someone's read a report saying it was you or I. So
right.
That's why she put me on antibiotics. It wraps up this Wednesday night, so that's why I figure I was just asking my
right. Upper respiratory tract infection, though, is a general term. So okay. Usually it's prefaced by either viral upper respiratory tract infection or bacterial. And so, but most upper respiratory tract infections, by the nature of the area affected, are usually viral. Bacterial right. infections, again, with bacterial infections, you tend to get a high fever that doesn't tend to go away after a few days. It tends to hover, and people generally get worse and worse over time. Viral infections just tend to sort of hover a bit and then gradually get better, and the person's able to function. They don't have a fever. They're not coughing up anything that's green continually through the day. So again, we have to be very careful when prescribing antibiotics for respiratory infections, because for the most part, for most people, it's viral and the antibiotic is not going to do very much. If an antibiotic is going to work for an infection, people tend to get better within a day or two. If someone still has symptoms 5 or 6 days afterwards and they're starting and they're on an antibiotic, it's unlikely that they had a bacterial infection.
Okay. I was just asking.
Sure.
Is it possible that this can keep coming back now?
It'll only keep coming back if you're re-exposed to people who are sick, because the virus is not something that lies dormant in your body. In fact, your body destroys the virus every time you get infected. Okay. But if you're around people that are sick and they pass on the virus to you again, sure, it can happen again. But if you're away from those people, and in the summertime it tends to be less of an issue, then you'll find that the frequency of getting ill becomes less.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, John.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye now. Going to go to line 3, and good afternoon to Anne in Ottawa. Hello, Anne, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi.
Yes. I want to know, is there anything special that causes your ankles to swell?
There are.
I'm an elderly person, and I'm taking Deldiazem,
mm-hmm.
30 milligram, and another one I'm taking is Rempril,
mm-hmm.
10 mg.
Okay. Well, ankle swelling, there are several things that can cause swelling. Swelling can either be from inflammation, so damage to the ankle, an ankle sprain or an ankle injury.
Mm-hmm.
Other things that can cause ankle swelling, as we get older, our circulatory system, that is the arteries and veins that go down and come up from our lower legs and feet and ankles, tend to get leakier.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we tend to see is over the course of a day, the ankles can swell up because water just accumulates down there. It's at the lowest part of our body, and so the weight of our body and the column of the weight of the water in our body just squeezes water out into our feet. And what you may find that at night when your feet are up and you wake up in the morning, the swelling is not as bad.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that we call dependent edema. And it's called dependent edema. Edema means swelling or fluid due to fluid. And it's dependent because it depends on the position of your body. So if you're standing, it's more likely to happen. Mm-hmm. If you're lying or your feet are up, lying down or your feet are up, it's less likely to occur because it's the effect of gravity on your body when you're standing up. Certain medications can cause swelling of the ankles. So, for example, the diltiazem you're on might cause a little bit of ankle swelling. The Ramipril really shouldn't. If the ankle swelling becomes uncomfortable, that is, if it's making it difficult to walk or your feet get pain, you have pain in your feet because they get very tight when you're walking, there are pressure stockings that can be used almost ankle or knee high that are very comfortable to wear that can also reduce the swelling in the feet because they put pressure on the surface of the skin on your foot and ankle to prevent the water from squeezing out. It literally holds the water back. And so those are some of the ways to deal with that. Again, it's not uncommon. In fact, it's very common to see ankle swelling occur.
Mm-hmm.
The question becomes the cause of it. And your physician should be able to outline for you what the cause may be. But the most common causes are medication-related, age-related conditions, just the effect of age on our circulatory system. And mm-hmm. and there, it's fairly straightforward to treat if it becomes uncomfortable.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Dorothy.
You're very welcome, Anne.
Bye-bye.
All the best. Bye-bye now. And what we're going to do is we're going to take a small break and come back to your calls. We have Steve and Metcalf, Marcel in Orleans, and Jim and Chelsea who are waiting on the line, and we should be able to get all your calls today. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and we will be back in just a couple of minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. FRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Back to the phone lines. Good afternoon to Steve and Metcalf.
How are you, Dr. Dworkin?
I'm fine. How are you?
Thank you. I'm well. I'm a proponent that you should be the next chief medical officer for the city of Ottawa, I believe.
I'm not a fan of bureaucracy. I think that would be a death sentence for me.
Well, it would be a breath of fresh air for everybody in the city.
You know what? People ask me, you know, do you want to go into politics? I go, you know, I'm not a committee person. I'm quite authoritarian when it comes to making decisions, and I know myself. And if I were to work in a committee, and I've done sort of this kind of stuff in the past, I would be extremely frustrated because I go crazy when people just talk and talk and talk and come to no decision.
Understood. And hats off. To get to the point,
sure.
You're an advocate of inoculation for MMR, for measles, mumps, and rubella.
Yes.
And I'm at odds with it, and I'll tell you, we have three children, and today they are 12, 8, and 5.
Mm-hmm.
And wonderful children. The 8-year-old was born at 12 pounds by cesarean 12 hours after the water broke.
Right.
And not realized at the time, thinking we were blessed with the same good fortune as our first child. 2 years old, I was more quiet than the other. Our family physician, the father of five, said, "Oh, boys are slower than girls. Don't mm-hmm. worry." And so we had him go through his inoculation, MMR, and within 3 days he broke out in a rash on his face, similar to the measles, and almost a thrush mouth. And he went off food completely and started staring into lights and then following the pattern. And so he's autistic, nonverbal.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done the homeopath route, with a very good homeopath out in Perth. We done the cod liver. He became anemic. We took him off the milk. He was milkaholic, as most autistic children tend to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've graduated through it. I've done Porsche School, the one-on-one intensive behavior therapy, for 18 months. He's exhausted all of that, and he's in regular schooling system, and they're going to move him through the system, and he can say 100 words.
Mm.
He's a computer nut. Then we found out when this one was diagnosed that we were pregnant with number 3. And it's a boy.
Oh, wow. And
we just were so afraid. He hasn't had any inoculations.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is weighing on me now, of course, especially since the school asks, for the document to be signed, if you're going to waive on it. And so I listened to you adamantly about saying, you don't want to end up with shingles when you're an old guy. And
yeah.
So you want to end up looking after this when you're younger.
Sure.
And so now I'm at odds. If I give him an inoculation, do I cause something? And our family physician says, you know, we've said, why don't we use the single vial dose of MMR rather than the 100 cc bottles that are shipped around the province? But you can't get the single dose vials here in Ontario. Apparently, it's an American thing. They decided to get rid of the preservative completely by going single dose bottles only.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, really a complicated issue for us to say, okay, am I hindering or am I helping?
Right.
And I know you're going to say, Steve, just go there and get it done and get it over with.
Well, no, I think it's important to, you know, to understand the angst you're going through, right? I mean, this is not an esoteric subject for you. This is real. And so obviously when you have a child that has an illness, you're fraught with fear that this is going to happen again. And so that's completely understandable. And so it's a matter of then saying, okay, what do we know about autism now that we didn't know, say, 10 years ago? And what, in fact, has happened this year is that they have uncovered, what we didn't have 10 years ago was a means of evaluating brain function using what we call functional MRIs, where you actually look at areas of the brain that are associated with various cognitive functions. And when a child, for example, is 4 months old, it's very difficult for a four-month-old to know whether they have the propensity for autism or not. And so you only tend to see that appear as the child develops. And when they reach a year of age, their language skills improve, their cognitive function. I mean, it's explosive brain growth over that time. And what tended to happen is that vaccinations, especially for measles, were given at around a year of age, at the same time that the brain would be functioning at a much higher level. And so diagnoses tended to follow around that time. But what we have found out this year, in fact, just I think it was 3 or 4 weeks ago, is that through functional MRIs, they're finding that children who are autistic now can be found to be autistic at around 4 months of age, way before the MMR vaccine is even given. And so the issue becomes one of looking at what we know today and what we know in terms of the claim that MMR causes autism. We know that the original study that was done by Andrew Wakefield was discredited because he falsified his data. And he falsified, and he was essentially doing work for various legal entities that wanted to show that there was some sort of association between autism and the MMR vaccine. And he had
opening
done,
up the door for massive class actions.
Right, exactly. So if we know that there is that these children that are going to develop autism are developing it now before the age of 1 year, it then weakens the claim that the MMR vaccine given at a year is causing the autism. This may be something where, again, through the evidence that we have, that the disease itself is not something that just starts after the vaccine is given, but rather is a progressive illness that only expresses itself around the same time that we give a vaccine. So that's the issue. I can't convince you. I'm not trying to convince you. My job is to try and give you information so that you can then say for yourself if you're comfortable with your decision on the basis of the evidence that's out there. But I am not. I don't chastise people. I don't criticize people for the decisions that they make. They're trying to make decisions in the best interest of their children. And so, again, it's understandable that you're reticent to give the vaccine given the history that you've elucidated just earlier on this call.
You know, our youngest boy, we in anticipation that we would go through the similar items, through OCTC and CHIL, and we had both psychiatrists and therapists evaluations done, where we would sit on the other side of the two-way mirror mm-hmm. and watch the assessments. And so the youngest, rather than give him a full autistic, they put him in the spectrum by calling him PDD,
mm-hmm.
NOS, not otherwise specified.
Right.
And so both boys experience speech-language therapy at OCTC. They go through occupational therapy, trying to learn how to hold a pen. He's wonderful with dump trucks and dinosaurs, and I tell you, it's in the DNA already that he's a boy.
Yeah.
And nothing that we had to teach him. But now I'm afraid that, do I leave well enough alone, or am I going to trigger something? And my thought, since this, I knew absolutely nothing, as the rest of the world did, about autism prior to
right.
what is autism when they tell us our boy has it. And so you become an advocate.
Absolutely.
And so when I started to read, I thought, is there immune deficiency at a lower level than the average bear? And what happens is we overwhelm them with an inoculation at that point in time. Do I allow him to graduate or grow older? As you suggested, the brain cells are, you know, exponentially growing. And are we giving him a leg up by letting him go a little bit older before inoculating? And yet I've heard on your show that that may be a point, because there's a suggestion now that a second inoculation should take place because the first one may have worn off.
Well, it's actually more that the second, there have always been two MMR vaccines given at a certain interval. And the reason is that you build up a certain, about 80% of kids will have full antibody response, and the remaining 20% may not have full, they only have partial. And so getting the second vaccine brings them up to 100%. With regards to immune function, I think it's important to keep in mind is that every child, regardless of whatever condition they have, is being exposed on average to anywhere between 200 to 250,000 assaults on their body a day from the external environment with regards to stimulating their immune system. And so if a vaccine contains one or two more of those out of 250,000, it's not really overwhelming their system. It's also important, and I've only got about 20 seconds left, Steve, but it's also important to keep in mind that the disease itself is a neurological disease. And we're seeing more and more of these infections in Europe. They're up to 15,000 in France because of not vaccinating. So unfortunately, I have to end it there, Steve. But you know what? If you want to call back next week and continue the conversation, because it's
a very important one.
All the best to you. And unfortunately, we can't get to the other calls. My thanks to Sebastian Trombley for producing Sunday House Call. And we will be back next week with another edition. Great calls today, everybody. Have a great week.